Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 152, Recovery. This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by The Loop Knittery in New Zealand at loopknittery.co.nz and Holiday Travel, who along with Craftlit and Knitty.com will be taking you to London, Bath, and Wales next October 2010. Please go to craftlit.com and look in the upper right-hand corner where you can click on a logo that will take you a page that will tell you more. For those of you who are new to Craftlit, please take a moment to visit our library at craftlit.com. From there, you can listen to or download all previous episodes. And along with a link to our trip to London, Bath, and Wales, you can also find a link on the left sidebar to our iPhone iTouch application, which puts all the Craftlit archived audio and show notes into the palm of your hand. So, hi! For those of you who have just downloaded everything and have started listening rapidly, it's like I just talked to you a few minutes ago, but for those of you listening in real time, it's been a couple of weeks. I have been in the middle of the wedding maelstrom, and it's been good. It's been hectic, but it's been good, because none of us really thought clearly through the fact that December 12th would also be the end of the teaching semester, the pre-Christmas shopping, or in my case, knitting season, and, you know, just a lot of stuff. So it was interesting. All the finals were due Friday. The rehearsal dinner was Friday night. The wedding was Saturday, and all my grades were due into the department's hands on Monday. So that was a frenzy for me. But it all worked out really well. There were only two grades that I'm going to have to redo, which I feel really bad about, but that's what happens when you hand your papers in late. Those of you who are in college, never, never, never assume that your professor is going to be in as good a mood at the end of the semester as they are even midway through. So when you say, "Is it okay if I turn this paper in late or at the end of the semester instead of now?" And they say yes, don't wait for the last day. I'm not kidding you. I had a kid turn in a paper at 1 a.m. Friday morning. What are you going to do, huh? I don't know. Anyway, a lot of stuff has been happening on this end of the continent. I have spoken German to actual Germans. I have not done it well, but I have done it competently enough. Or they're just geniuses and they understood what I was trying to say. It's probably the latter rather than the former. But things are good. You know, I finished the wedding shawl. I actually finished it on Monday before the wedding, which was a relief. Blocked it. I posted a picture of it to the show notes. I was very happy with how it turned out. My sister doesn't knit. So she just said, "Wow, that's really pretty." Everybody who actually does knit gasped when they saw it. So I kind of felt like that was, you know, that's kind of what you're hoping for when you knit an Estonian lace shawl for somebody's wedding in a cashmere silk blend. All of the details about what yarn I used and how little of it there was to complete the project are up on Ravelry. It's a pattern that I shared with the Craftlit group. So if you're on Ravelry, make sure you tootle over to the Craftlit group within the group section. We've also had some very interesting conversations going on over in the Ravelry Craftlit Flatland group. There's some stuff that I'm going to share with you a little bit later that I thought you might be interested in. As far as knitting goes, now that it's post-wedding and pre-Christmas, I am knitting as fast as I can on hats and socks and shrugs and things like that that I think people might like because, as I mentioned before, this year's Christmas is entirely about stash knitting and even some stash spinning and knitting just to get the right color, you know? So it is a frenzy of yarn over here. I am so not going to make the deadline. I'm hoping that I can hold other work at bay until I'm done with the knitting thing. I'm also hoping that I'm going to be able to podcast one more time before Christmas, but I kind of doubt it. I think it's going to be the night after Christmas that I'll be able to podcast again. I really missed getting the word out to you, and especially when I saw the comments on Ravelry and the emails that I've gotten about Flatland and how much you're enjoying it. I really felt bad about not being able to get to the microphone over the last couple of weeks, but I also received lovely emails from you about the wedding and your understanding of the situation and all that, and I really appreciate that. I know it's hard to wait, especially when the book is good, and this one is. So we're going to talk about the next couple chapters, and you're going to love them. I have a little announcement. I tweeted a while back about a hack, a Macintosh hack. People are taking those little netbooks, the little cheap $200 and $300 netbooks, and they are backwards hacking them so that you could run the Apple operating system on them. So that would be the latest Snow Leopard, I guess. I passed this information on to one of my geek kids from the university who is prone to, you know, taking computers apart and putting them back together again. He is very interested in this whole Mac hack idea of creating a Macintosh, functionally a Macintosh computer out of a $350 netbook. He obviously would have to invest in the $350 netbook and then a few other pieces of machinery, and what you'd wind up with is a $500 or $600 netbook that is, for all intents and purposes, an Apple computer. If you are interested in purchasing something like this, or even if you have a netbook that you would like to get hacked and would want to do some kind of trade thing with him, I know he's very amenable to all sorts of creative ideas. He is interested in building these for people. So if you are interested as well, please email me, heather@craftlit.com, and I will get you in touch with my little code monkey from the university. He's really quite talented and a very bright kid, and I'm excited to see what he can pull off with this. He's working on his first one right now, so you would not be the guinea pig. He would actually have completed successfully one of these before anything happens officially. So that's one of the little sidelines. Well, the other one is, if you get Spinoff, you will notice that I had an article in the winter 2009 issue. It was on the knitted, hand-spun, and hand-knit, and hand-crocheted, and hand-beaded rancho that my guild created. It is this humongous, it's like 2 8-foot-long tables side by side worth of hand-spun and hand-knit rancho. Barns with, you know, wire fences enclosing pigs with chickens running amok, and a little spinning woman who looks remarkably like the woman, Jill, who created her. And oh, it's just wonderful. And the pictures are really lovely, and they were not taken by me. They were taken by Mike Hedrick. If you ever need pictures taken in Tucson, I suggest you contact Mike, preferably through me, because then he wouldn't be frightened at having strange people contact him. But he's a lovely photographer, and he's done yeoman service for the guild in the past. His wife is a wonderful woman and a member since before I got there. And it's really lovely. I wrote the article 2 years ago, so we were all very, very excited to see it in there. And of course, I forgot to send them my bio, so unless you know me from Craftlit, you have no idea who wrote that article. So much for pre-publicity, right? My fault. I went too fast. So there it is. On the upside, I have some book reviews for you, and one of these books is going to become the December incentive. I get, from time to time, as you know, I get books from Interweave. And I know that some of you have gone out to purchase these books, and that's why they keep sending me new ones that I can then release as incentives to you. I'm not required to. It's one of the things that I've asked them, you know, can I then use these books? And they're like, yes, do whatever you want. You know, that's their copies for you to, you know, do with what you will. So what I will is I will send these to the December incentive winner. If you donate in the month of December, I put your name in a hat and I draw it, and I'm going to announce the November winners shortly. But first, I actually have three books to tell you about in this episode. 101 Wire Earrings, or 101 Wire Earrings, Step-by-Step Projects and Techniques by Denise Peck. This is the woman who's the editor of that Step-by-Step Wire Jewelry magazine that I mentioned eons ago as having been such a darn good magazine. Well, here she is, and she's doing step-by-step projects and techniques for earrings in a book. There are 101, just like the 101 sweater book thing that we talked about two episodes ago, I think. In this book, they have excellent, really, truly excellent photographs. Very nice, clear, and coherent up-close pictures of how to do all sorts of really kind of intricate little things for wire jewelry. How to do coils and spirals and jump rings, you know, all the kinds of things that you would expect. But also things like piercing and oxidizing, which simply does not look as scary as one might think. And then beautiful pictures of the projects. Now, once you get into the projects themselves, you do not any longer get step-by-step instructions. However, they're all, as in the magazine, rated on a 1, 2, or 3 jump ring level of difficulty, which I really love. And after having gone through, well, I really did actually spend a lot of time, and I think I read almost every one of these little pattern instructions. I think they're pretty darn close when I consider that I am a beginner. The things that are listed as beginner wire works are definitely things I feel comfortable doing myself. The mid-range things I look at and I go, well, yeah, no, I understand that, and I've done stuff like that. I think that's pretty mid-range. The ones that are listed as having 3 jump rings as a level of difficulty, yeah, I think they really do hit the 3 level. Every once in a while, there's something that comes in at 2 that requires way more spiraling, or way more accurate spiraling than I've done in the past. Little coils and things that really need to look good in order for the earrings to look good, which sounds like an oxymoron, but you know, sometimes you can kind of fake it. Yeah, in some of these you really can't. But this book, if you are interested in earrings and you have even the most basic tools, just, you know, wire cutters, the flat square nose plier and a round nose plier, you can probably do, I'd say most, definitely most, the vast majority of most of these earrings. So if that's something you're interested in, this is a really good starter book for wire jewelry. Just earrings, nothing more than that. Although obviously you fabulously creative people could easily take an earring and turn it into a pendant or even a ring. It's very easy to see how that could happen with almost any of the instructions in this book. So this book is recommended to you, but also it is going out as the December incentive book. And then as a smaller kind of, you know, sideline, I completely buried this underneath the books from previous months. I have a set of stitch markers, beautiful little kind of a clear blue, like a sky blue and Kelly and kind of moss green stitch markers. These are the ones that were handmade by Joy Lynn in Massachusetts. I still don't have a website for her or an Etsy store for her, but she does lovely work. I think she sells it locally to her in Massachusetts, not to me. And so one of her packets of stitch markers will go out as a second December incentive. Now, as far as our next two books go, these are very different. The second book is the Enchanted Adornments book. This is, again, an interweave book, creating mixed media jewelry with metal, clay, wire, resin, and more. This is by Cynthia Thornton. And the book is gorgeous, which, you know, I mean, if you have spent any time with interweave books, you're used to the gorgeousness of the books. It's just simply the way things are. This book, I am resisting weekly this book, and I'll tell you why. I don't have a job. And because of that, I fear this book. There are so many things in here that I really want to do. These are, I mean, there's like woodland wings, these gossamer wing, like fairy wing pendants that she's made on a gorgeous kind of an antiqued looking necklace that's just, oh my gosh, just stupendous stuff. She has fake scrimshaw stuff. She instructs you on how to do resin, on how to do texture stamps, how to create your own texture stamps, how to create your own texture cards, simple tools, more expensive tools, how to use metal clay, which I'd never even heard about because I don't do this stuff very much, different polymer techniques, things that I've always wondered about but never knew. She also has wonderful ideas for how to store the clay and how not to waste your clay. And then she does this really lovely thing. She starts to create different pieces, all in very different styles. And instead of just kind of, you know, saying, oh, and here's another necklace, oh, and here's some earrings, oh, and here's a pendant, she actually has created kind of a mythic landscape with a storyline. It's almost like a scavenger hunt storyline. And she has to go through, kind of travel through. Do you remember those old Griffin and Sabine books? Griffin and Sabine. This is kind of like that. So the second half of this book, you have this lovely narrative that's really quite fun to read. And along with that narrative, you get instructions on how to make the jewelry that would have been made for these characters who she comes across. And so, as I said, very, very different techniques, very, very different, gosh, everything, just the tools and the media that she uses to create these things. It's so varied and, yeah, it's really, really beautiful. At some point, this will come up in early 2010 as an incentive book. For now, I'm just going to tell you about it because if you know someone who likes to create not necessarily really intricate, but really unique kinds of jewelry and is either just starting out or is really ready to take the next step and do something far more complicated than they have before using a technique or a substance that they haven't used before, this is a good holiday book to get for them. Enchanted Adornments, Creating Mixed Media Jewelry with Metal Clay, Wire, Resin, and More by Cynthia Thornton. And I will put this up on the show notes so that you will be able to get a link to the Interweave site in case you wanted to either order it, which might be kind of late right now, or if you wanted to head off to your local bookstore and see if you can pick up a copy. I always find it's easier to find the book when I know what the cover looks like. And speaking to that, this is a wonderful cover. It's a very simple cover of just someone's kind of midriff and skirt. But this is called this is our last book, So Liberated, S-E-W, Liberated, 20 Stylish Products for the Modern Sewist by Meg McElby. This book, those of you who sew are going to love. I want you to listen to this. You hear the crinkling? That's because at the back of the book, there is an envelope, and I have resisted opening that envelope, which is an envelope full of patterns. Actual pattern paper is included with this. It's a brilliant little book. And honestly, if I were even 10 years younger, I'd be wearing a lot of the things in here. Somehow, after having two children, I just don't think some of the stuff is going to look quite right on my body. I am merely old, not svelte and young and cute anymore. However, aside from the clothes that I wouldn't wear, there are a lot of things in here that I would use. There are, I'm going back to the table of contents. There are purses and lunch sacks and placemats and really cute aprons and things for little kids and things for grown-ups and silk. There's a silk lap quilt that's just lovely. And I had a really good time reading Meg's opening to this book. She has an introduction called Why I Stitch. And it's really a lovely story. She's traveled quite a bit, and she's one of those people who, like knitters and crocheters with yarn, how you kind of don't throw your scraps out. She did the same thing with fabric. And she wound up, because she didn't want to waste anything, she wound up using it to applique. And she appliques in some fairly interesting ways that I'm sure people who know more about it would go, oh yeah, well, of course. But for me, I'm a competent seamstress. I can build clothes, but I don't know, kind of making them pretty beyond just the normal sewing, you know, adding things to them. It's not something that I've ever really done before. All of my adornment has either been lousy embroidery or adding knitting to something, felting like that. So I learned quite a bit reading through her book. I also was very happy that when she goes into her equipment, tools, and supplies, she doesn't just leave you with, you need a sewing machine, you need to be able to zigzag, you need some pins, and you need a straight edge. She actually includes photographs of the different kinds of presser feet for sewing machines. Some of these I knew about, some of these I'd never seen before, and they look like alien spacecraft to me. But boy, was it good to learn what those things were. So if you are a seamstress, or if you are trying to get into doing more things like applique and, you know, doing some really beautiful additional work with, well, shoot, anything you've created that you just want to make even that much prettier, this is a great book for you. And again, it's So Liberated, S-E-W, Liberated, 20 Stylish Projects for the Modern Sewist by Meg McElwee. And, you know, go to Amazon and put it on your wish list, and maybe someone will get it for you in the last minute panic before Christmas. But that book is also going to become, eventually in the new year, one of our incentives. And speaking of incentives, I need to announce our November incentive winners. Our first incentive winner, and I should do the drum roll. Da-da-da. Our first incentive winner is Elizabeth in Massachusetts. Elizabeth, you have won Sweater 101. This is the book I reviewed a couple of episodes ago, How to Plan Sweaters That Fit by Cheryl Burnett, and it is a signed copy. So congratulations, Elizabeth. Very exciting. And our second winner, because I had two books up, this is my last signed copy of When Autumn Leaves by our own listener, Amy S. Foster. This is going to Gail of California. Yay! Congratulations! So congratulations to you as well. I will get those out to you as soon as I possibly can. So one last announcement before we move on to our Flatland chapters for today. So exciting! One of the things that I've been thinking about with the iPhone application as I was kind of, you know, mulling over what I was going to put on as an extra for this next go-round of the application. And of course, these PDF extras that are going out with the iPhone application are basically the show notes plus a little something. The plus a little something will get posted for everyone on the next episode's show notes. So there will always be kind of a running tag team of these things. I'll also make sure that on the library page, you have a link to the audio, a link to the show notes, and then retroactively, the link to the PDF will also be there. Since I've only started those in the last few episodes, they'll just kind of start popping up as we go along. I'm not going to go back in time and create PDF extras for episodes that have already gone by, because honestly, that would kill me. There's just not enough hours in the day for me to do that. But going forward, those will continue. So I mentioned before the idea that I wanted to include patterns. And so far we've had the winner of the 2009 Craftlit Challenge. Kathleen's pattern is out there for you. I think that was with episode 150. Last episode, little bits and pieces of things went out. This episode, there will be a pattern as long as I can get the contract written in time, because I am trying to get this kind of codified. I want to have a contract so that people are protected, so that everybody knows how long their patterns will be available for, because some people want to be able to sell them on Ravelry or elsewhere, which I certainly appreciate and encourage. But it occurred to me that there's more than patterns going on with Craftlit listeners. There are patterns, there are cross-stitch instructions. You guys are always coming up with the most amazing things, polymer clay instructions, things like this, but you're also a bookish lot. And it occurred to me while I was driving to go pick up my kids today that perhaps some of you have written short stories or even episodic short stories that you might like to share with a group of people who you think would be interested or interested in or appreciative of what you're writing. Now, obviously, with Craftlit, I work hard to make sure that this is a clean podcast that kids could listen to as well as adults. And I'd kind of put out the same with the short stories. You know, it'd need to be appropriate for all eyes. Not necessarily that the content is child-oriented, because obviously the Scarlet Letter isn't, but that, you know, the language that you use, normally I wouldn't ask anyone to edit themselves for something like that, but since this is going out under the Craftlit aegis, and since I mark these podcasts as clean in the iTunes website, you know, store place thing, I'd kind of want to keep with that, and I think you understand and appreciate that fact. But if you do have something you would like to share, even if it's not exactly what I've already talked about, but you're kind of curious, email me. Email Heather at craftlit.com and put in the subject line something for the iPhone app or something like that. I have heard that there might be a way to do this for the BlackBerry sooner rather than later. And so I will, I'll do what I can to find out if there's a way that we can get all of the Craftlit backlog catalog onto BlackBerries as well as onto the iPhones and the iTouches. One of our listeners has found the entire Anglo-Saxon poetic record read aloud. And she said she found it for the iPhone, and I'm going to try and find the link to that that she had mentioned so that I could link to it from our show notes. And then this again comes from Ravelry. One of our listeners said this really isn't a Flatland discussion, nor is it a what I'm reading, so I thought I'd start a new thread. Many years ago when my son was in middle school, he was in the sadly typical I hate math, it's boring funk, when I found the book The Number Devil, A Mathematical Adventure by Hans Magnus Enzensberger, translated by Michael Henry Heim. It is a fantastic children's story about young Robert who is tired of dreaming until the number devil comes to his dreams, 12 in all, and poses fascinating theories and adventures about Fibonacci numbers, infinite and prime numbers, etc. It really revived my son's interest in math. As an adult, I've read E equals MC squared, a biography of the world's most famous equation by David Badanis, another interesting way to read about and begin to understand math and physics while still using words, history, and a storyline rather than the often drier, more analytical or symbolic structure. That was from Isipo, who asked if there was other literature out there for math phobes. One reader, Eglet, mentions Gerdelescher Bach, which was written by a guy who I think I have mentioned on the podcast. He wrote a fabulous book on translation called Le Tombeau des Marauds, L-E-T-O-N, Le Tombeau, B-E-A-U, D-E, Marauds, M-A-R-O-T, which is, you know, 17 inches thick. No, really, it's probably close to four. It's big, as is Gerdelescher Bach. But wow, a really, really interesting book. And then, Isabeau was the second reader, and I'm just going to get this all messed up. Eglet then said, Danica McKellar, you may recognize her name because she used to be on The Wonder Years. She went on to get a PhD in math and has written a couple of kids' books about math. One of them is specifically algebra-oriented, I think, that have been really well-reviewed on the radio. And this is the one I was thinking of. They're more girl-oriented, but she says they're good for anyone. And I will put a link to that book that Danica wrote. Very exciting. I was very happy when I saw that she was, you know, off and running and being genius girl and stuff like that. I thought that was really quite wonderful because she's also beautiful. And I think, you know, as much as I hate to admit it, people will pay attention when the pretty girl starts talking math. So there it is, you know, we're that visual world of people. One of the things I am hoping to do between now and Christmas is edit my audio with the good men at the Plato and a Platypus franchise, the Heidegger and a Hippo walk through those pearly gates. Many of you who listen to NPR have probably already heard them being interviewed with, was it on Weekend Edition? I think it was. Anyway, they are a hoot and a half, and I will be sure to get that audio to you really, truly as fast as I can. It's, as you know, been hectic, and I just haven't had time to sit down and edit audio. And it's once again the same problem of me having to edit all of my cackling out because they just make me giggle ferociously and unstoppably. So it's embarrassing, but there it is. There's not much I can do about it. They're just funny guys. But Flatland. So today we have sections 6 and 7 of Flatland. Now, as you may recall, when we left off, A Square was telling us about how people were able to see each other in Flatland. And in fact, in today's chapters or sections, we're going to learn more about that. And again, this gives wonderful opportunity to vast social satire, and that's great, but there's also going to be some actually rather complicated geometry in section 6. There are 3 figures. I'm putting all of these figures into the iPhone PDF and on the show notes, just as I have before. These are actually pictures that, even with the description, I don't know for certain that I would have drawn them accurately if I had tried to sketch them while I was listening. So if you aren't entirely sure you're getting it, I'm going to post in the show notes a minute range for where you can stop and go look at the picture and then restart, in case your MP3 player or your iTunes doesn't, for whatever reason, restart exactly where you left off. Now, this is one thing that's happening with my own copy of the iPhone application. I'm so not sure what's going on, but I'm asking the people who created it to see if there's a way to fix it so that it can memorize where you stopped listening to an episode. I thought I'd seen a setting for that when I set everything up, and I thought I marked that as something I wanted, and then I have no idea what's going on. So we'll figure it out. But until then, I am going to mark in the show notes the minutes where the figures get mentioned, so you can go back and pick that up again when you are, in fact, looking at the drawings. It will make a lot more sense. Is that I need to remind you what I mentioned in the previous podcast, that the two-dimensional world for a square is being perceived one-dimensionally, just kind of straight across. You know, he can only see that practically, like, you know, different kinds of line segments, which people have been commenting on the Ravelry group comments, that this is kind of confusing. Well, he solves that problem here, just like he kind of solved the light source problem by external light just kind of radiating through the plane, he comes up with another clever solution to the vision problem that is inherent with the geometry of Flatland. His explanation is one of the reasons why you kind of need to look at the figure sketches that he drew to help you kind of parse how he's envisioned the ability to recognize each other by sight when really all you can see is line segments. It's impossible to know if you're looking at a woman from the side or a triangle from the side. And here he actually does solve that problem. There is a pun in here that I'm going to tell you about after chapter 6, because some of you are going to get it and I don't want to spoil it for you. There is also towards the end, he is making the comparison that, well, at the time, and this is in one of the notes, the sidebar notes to this annotated copy. During Victorian time, it was very popular and I think very accepted to believe that social status mattered more than ability. And this is why you have, well, golly, all of masterpiece theater from the 70s and the 80s, you know, any text that they decided to perform for the masses all kind of dealt with how unfair, you know, the innate unfairness of the people with land and money moving ahead while the people with talent and humor and brains and ethics were left behind, you know. And you can just kind of cast a net across all of literature and yank in a whole bunch of stuff from the 17 and 1800s and even into the 1900s that fits that bill. And this book absolutely does. He's commenting on that flawed belief system. And so that's what you're hearing is, in fact, what you're hearing. There is also a comment, and it comes and goes. He makes a comment about deaf education, which I thought was kind of interesting because I worked with deaf kids when I was in high school and was pretty good with American Sign Language. I knew my stuff. I could communicate. And I know that when I was involved in the Arizona School for the Deaf and Blind, there was quite a hubbub going on related to the benefits, or I guess the question of whether there are benefits to learning oral language versus learning sign language, or whether it had to be one or the other, or whether it could be both. And I know there were really quite strong camps on both sides of the deaf ed fence, some who were absolutely oralist and some who were absolutely manual. And very rarely did I find anyone who was in the middle going, wow, you know, if you can learn to lip read and speak, that's great. And if you can't, here's sign language, and perhaps you should try both. It's kind of like the whole language versus phonics thing. You know, it's, well, you probably do need to know how to sound out words, because what happens when you come across some big long word that you don't know? And at the same time, you don't want everybody to be studying worksheets that have, you know, schwas in them when you're never going to come across that in a regular book. You know, somewhere in between the polar opposites lies sanity. Well, Abbott has this, like, it flies by, a comment on deaf education, and you get a pretty clear picture just from this brief comment of his on what deaf ed or attitudes towards deaf education must have been at the time. And I thought it was just interesting that he brought it up at all. I suppose it shouldn't have surprised me so much, but seeing as how so much of his commentary in the previous chapter had been about women, I was kind of expecting more of that. And here came something completely different. So good old Edwin Abbott had his finger on the pulse of many things going on in his society at his time. So I am going to stop blathering and I'm going to play you chapter 6 or section 6 of Flatland. And then I'll come back for chapter section 7. So here we go.
Part 1, Sections 6 and 7 of Flatland. Recording by Ruth Golding. Flatland, A Romance of Many Dimensions by Edwin Abbott Abbott. Part 1, Section 6. Of Recognition by Sight. I am about to appear very inconsistent. In previous sections I have said that all figures in Flatland present the appearance of a straight line, and it was added or implied that it is consequently impossible to distinguish by the visual organ between individuals of different classes. Yet now I am about to explain to my Spaceland critics how we are able to recognise one another by the sense of sight. If, however, the reader will take the trouble to refer to the passage in which recognition by feeling is stated to be universal, he will find this qualification: among the lower classes. It is only among the higher classes, and in our more temperate climates, that sight recognition is practised. That this power exists in any regions and for any classes is the result of fog, which prevails during the greater part of the year in all parts, save the torrid zones. That which is with you in Spaceland an unmixed evil, blotting out the landscape, depressing the spirits, and enfeebling the health, is by us recognised as a blessing scarcely inferior to air itself, and as the nurse of arts and parent of sciences. But let me explain my meaning, without further eulogies on this beneficent element. If fog were non-existent, all lines would appear equally and indistinguishably clear. And this is actually the case in those unhappy countries in which the atmosphere is perfectly dry and transparent. But wherever there is a rich supply of fog, objects that are at a distance, say, of 3 feet, are appreciably dimmer than those at a distance of 2 feet 11 inches. And the result is that by careful and constant experimental observation of comparative dimness and clearness, we are enabled to infer with great exactness the configuration of the object observed. An instance will do more than a volume of generalities to make my meaning clear. Suppose I see 2 individuals approaching, whose rank I wish to ascertain. They are, we will suppose, a merchant and a physician, or, in other words, an equilateral triangle and a pentagon. How am I to distinguish them? Reader's note: the following paragraph makes reference to an accompanying diagram. Diagram 1 is a rightward-pointing equilateral triangle, the vertical left-hand side of which is marked BC, the other 2 sides being marked BA and CA. Dotted lines are drawn from B and C to a point further to the right to form an isosceles triangle. The far right-hand point of this triangle represents the eye of the observer, and a horizontal dotted arrow pointing left from it indicates his eye glance. A broad vertical line, DAE, is drawn to indicate what the observer sees. DAE is bright at the centre and darkens sharply towards its ends. End of reader's note. It will be obvious to every child in Spaceland who has touched the threshold of geometrical studies that if I can bring my eye so that its glance may bisect an angle, A, of the approaching stranger, my view will lie, as it were, evenly between his 2 sides that are next to me, viz. CA and AB, so that I shall contemplate the 2 impartially, and both will appear of the same size. Now, in the case of 1, the merchant, what shall I see? I shall see a straight line, DAE, in which the middle point, A, will be very bright, because it is nearest to me. But on either side the line will shade away rapidly into dimness, because the sides AC and AB recede rapidly into the fog, and what appear to me as the merchant's extremities, viz. D and E, will be very dim indeed. Reader's note: the following paragraph makes reference to an accompanying diagram. Diagram 2 is a regular pentagon sitting on a horizontal base with C1 at the apex, A1 at middle right, and B1 at lower right. Longer dotted lines are drawn out towards the right, upwards from B1 and downwards from C1 to form an irregular pentagon. The far right-hand point of the extended pentagon represents the eye of the observer, and a dotted arrow pointing from it towards the centre of the lower left edge of the pentagon indicates his eye glance. Again, a broad line D1A1E1 parallel to the lower left edge of the pentagon is drawn to indicate what the observer sees. D1A1E1 is bright at the centre and darkens very gradually towards its ends. End of reader's note. On the other hand, in the case of 2, the physician, though I shall here also see a line, D1A1E1, with a bright centre, A1, yet it will shade away less rapidly into dimness, because the sides A1C1, A1B1, recede less rapidly into the fog. And what appear to me the physician's extremities, viz. D1 and E1, will be not so dim as the extremities of the merchant. The reader will probably understand from these two instances how, after a very long training supplemented by constant experience, it is possible for the well-educated classes among us to discriminate with fair accuracy between the middle and lowest orders by the sense of sight. If my Spaceland patrons have grasped this general conception so far as to conceive the possibility of it, and not to reject my account as altogether incredible, I shall have attained all I can reasonably expect. Were I to attempt further details, I should only perplex. Yet, for the sake of the young and inexperienced, who may perchance infer, from the two simple instances I have given above of the manner in which I should recognise my father and my sons, that recognition by sight is an easy affair, it may be needful to point out that in actual life most of the problems of sight recognition are far more subtle and complex. If, for example, when my father, the triangle, approaches me, he happens to present his side to me instead of his angle, then, until I have asked him to rotate, or until I have edged my eye round him, I am for the moment doubtful whether he may not be a straight line, or, in other words, a woman. Reader's note. The following paragraph makes reference to an accompanying diagram. The diagram shows a hexagon with points at top and bottom. The vertical right-hand side is marked AB. Dotted lines are drawn downward from the topmost and upward from the bottommost points of the hexagon and extended to the right until they meet, forming an irregular pentagon. The far right-hand point of the pentagon represents the eye of the observer. The line AB is extended to where it meets the dotted lines to form a broad vertical line CABD. The middle portion of this line, AB, is bright, and the outer portions darken towards C and D. End of reader's note. Again, when I'm in the company of one of my two hexagonal grandsons, contemplating one of his sides, AB, full front, it will be evident from the accompanying diagram that I shall see one whole line, AB, in comparative brightness, shading off hardly at all at the ends, and two smaller lines, CA and BD, dim throughout and shading away into greater dimness toward the extremities, C and D. But I must not give way to the temptation of enlarging on these topics. The meanest mathematician in Spaceland will readily believe me when I assert that the problems of life, which present themselves to the well-educated when they are themselves in motion, rotating, advancing or retreating, and at the same time attempting to discriminate by the sense of sight between a number of polygons of high rank moving in different directions, as, for example, in a ballroom or conversazione, must be of a nature to task the angularity of the most intellectual, and amply justify the rich endowments of the learned professors of geometry, both static and kinetic, in the illustrious University of Wentbridge, where the science and art of sight recognition are regularly taught to large classes of the elite of the states. It is only a few of the scions of our noblest and wealthiest houses who are able to give the time and money necessary for the thorough prosecution of this noble and valuable art. Even to me, a mathematician of no mean standing, and the grandfather of two most hopeful and perfectly regular hexagons, to find myself in the midst of a crowd of rotating polygons of the higher classes is occasionally very perplexing. And of course to a common tradesman or serf, such a sight is almost as unintelligible as it would be to you, my reader, were you suddenly transported into our country. In such a crowd you could see on all sides of you nothing but a line, apparently straight, but of which the parts would vary irregularly and perpetually in brightness or dimness. Even if you had completed your third year in the pentagonal and hexagonal classes in the university, and were perfect in the theory of the subject, you would still find that there was need of many years of experience before you could move in a fashionable crowd without jostling against your betters, whom it is against etiquette to ask to feel, and who, by their superior culture and breeding, know all about your movements, while you know very little or nothing about theirs. In a word, to comport oneself with perfect propriety in polygonal society, one ought to be a polygon oneself. Such, at least, is the painful teaching of my experience. It is astonishing how much the art, or I may almost call it instinct, of sight recognition is developed by the habitual practice of it, and by the avoidance of the custom of feeling. Just as with you, the deaf and dumb, if once allowed to gesticulate and to use the hand alphabet, will never acquire the more difficult but far more valuable art of lip speech and lip reading, so it is with us as regards seeing and feeling. None who in early life resort to feeling will ever learn seeing in perfection. For this reason, among our higher classes, feeling is discouraged or absolutely forbidden. From the cradle, their children, instead of going to the public elementary schools, where the art of feeling is taught, are sent to higher seminaries of an exclusive character. And at our illustrious university, to feel is regarded as a most serious fault, involving rustication for the first offence and expulsion for the second. But among the lower classes, the art of sight recognition is regarded as an unattainable luxury. A common tradesman cannot afford to let his son spend a third of his life in abstract studies. The children of the poor are therefore allowed to feel from their earliest years, and they gain thereby a precocity and an early vivacity which contrast at first most favourably with the inert, undeveloped, and listless behaviour of the half-instructed youths of the polygonal class. But when the latter have at last completed their university course and are prepared to put their theory into practice, the change that comes over them may almost be described as a new birth, and in every art, science, and social pursuit, they rapidly overtake and distance their triangular competitors. Only a few of the polygonal class fail to pass the final test or leaving examination at the university. The condition of the unsuccessful minority is truly pitiable. Rejected from the higher class, they are also despised by the lower. They have neither the matured and systematically trained powers of the polygonal bachelors and masters of arts, nor yet the native precocity and mercurial versatility of the youthful tradesman. The professions, the public services, are closed against them, and though in most states they are not actually debarred from marriage, yet they have the greatest difficulty in forming suitable alliances, as experience shows that the offspring of such unfortunate and ill-endowed parents is generally itself unfortunate, if not positively irregular. It is from these specimens of the refuse of our nobility that the great tumults and seditions of past ages have generally derived their leaders. And so great is the mischief thence arising that an increasing minority of our more progressive statesmen are of opinion that true mercy would dictate their entire suppression by enacting that all who fail to pass the final examination of the university should be either imprisoned for life or extinguished by a painless death. But I find myself digressing into the subject of irregularities, a matter of such vital interest that it demands a separate section.
All right, so before we head into section 7, did you hear the little pun? He talked about the University of Wentbridge, and he went to Cambridge. Get it? Cambridge? Wentbridge? Okay, so it was a little pun, but I thought it was worth pointing out. One of those good annotations where you kind of snicker. So now we are heading into irregular figures. Ooh, and did you catch that little comment at the end of the last thing about the extinguished by a painless death? A little Swiftian justice, perhaps? I felt that comment was that whole last section where he was talking about what happens to the people who fail their examinations and stuff like that was pretty harsh. But you're going to get into more of that same kind of harshness because, of course, irregular figures, you know, this is the era of Barnum and the Elephant Man and sanatoriums and people who didn't fit in, weren't treated very well, especially, and we've talked about this back with Scarlet Letter and even Jekyll and Hyde, this idea that, a beautiful countenance equals, on some level, your morality. And so here he's talking about, and I think he actually says this, I've written it down in my notes, geometrical and moral irregularity go hand in hand. And that's, someone who is living now in a country where we have the Americans with Disabilities Act that, you know, provides for people in wheelchairs or people who are on crutches or people who are otherwise challenged in their ability to get about in a mode that is fairly standard. I think you'll be shocked by some of the statements that he makes. And of course, once again, we can be fairly certain that since he is commenting on this, it is something that also horrifies him, which would mean we'd have a good time sitting over a pint and arguing about this stuff because, wow, it's surprising to people in today's day and age to hear somebody speaking this way about people who are different than you might be. There are all sorts of things in the annotations about symmetry, which is obviously, since we're talking about irregularity, symmetry comes in, and The annotations are fascinating, but they are very mathematical. And I just wanted to throw something out. Humans are supposed to be attracted to symmetry of face. And if I recall correctly, the last time there was a big, like, Time Magazine or Newsweek article on symmetry of face, the person out in, out in the media who was described as having the most symmetrical face was Denzel Washington. Which I love because I love him. My mom loves him. My sister loves him. We all, Denzel. So I think I read that somewhere. You'll probably correct me, but if not, yay, Denzel, way to be symmetrical. Along with the symmetry thing, you're also going to hear a lot of commentary on, obviously, beauty and desirability and morality. And of course, if one of the things that we are to take away is that attractive people are attracted to other attractive people, then it's very possible that genetically they're going to pass on that symmetry of line or that attractiveness. However, when it comes to something like morality, that's a whole different ball of wax. So it's interesting because Abbott's making these comments so long before there's real genetic scientific data to back anything that he's saying, but he sure gets a lot of it right, or at least where I would put rightness to be. The other thing, just so you know, that is said over and over again in the annotations, especially to this chapter, is that Abbott's mathematical language is chosen very carefully and very accurately. One of the places where he simply does not mess up is in his math, and certainly not in his geometry. There's more of that kind of Swiftian modest proposal that's going to pop up in and out of this chapter as well. And I think that will be fun for you too. So I'm going to let the audio play out, and that will be the end of this episode. I hope you have a great Christmas. I can't imagine I'm going to talk to you before that. So let this be my warm wishes to you and yours. Have fun with Chapter 7.
Section 7 of Irregular Figures. Throughout the previous pages, I have been assuming, what perhaps should have been laid down at the beginning as a distinct and fundamental proposition, that every human being in Flatland is a regular figure, that is to say, of regular construction. By this I mean that a woman must not only be a line, but a straight line, that an artisan or soldier must have two of his sides equal, that tradesmen must have three sides equal, lawyers, of which class I am a humble member, four sides equal, and generally that in every polygon all the sides must be equal. The size of the sides would, of course, depend upon the age of the individual. A female at birth would be about an inch long, while a tall adult woman might extend to a foot. As to the males of every class, it may be roughly said that the length of an adult's sides, when added together, is 3 feet or a little more. But the size of our sides is not under consideration. I am speaking of the equality of sides. And it does not need much reflection to see that the whole of the social life in Flatland rests upon the fundamental fact that nature wills all figures to have their sides equal. If our sides were unequal, our angles would be unequal. Instead of its being sufficient to feel or estimate by sight a single angle in order to determine the form of an individual, it would be necessary to ascertain each angle by the experiment of feeling. But life would be too short for such a tedious groping. The whole science and art of sight recognition would at once perish. Feeling, so far as it is an art, would not long survive. Intercourse would become perilous or impossible. There would be an end to all confidence, all forethought. No one would be safe in making the most simple social arrangements. In a word, civilization would relapse into barbarism. Am I going too fast to carry my readers with me to these obvious conclusions? Surely a moment's reflection and a single instance from common life must convince everyone that our whole social system is based upon regularity or equality of angles. You meet, for example, two or three tradesmen in the street, whom you recognise at once to be tradesmen by a glance at their angles and rapidly bedimmed sides, and you ask them to step into your house to lunch. This you do at present with perfect confidence, because everyone knows to an inch or two the area occupied by an adult triangle. But imagine that your tradesman drags behind his regular and respectable vertex a parallelogram of 12 or 13 inches in diagonal. What are you to do with such a monster sticking fast in your house door? But I am insulting the intelligence of my readers by accumulating details which must be patent to everyone who enjoys the advantages of a residence in Spaceland. Obviously, the measurements of a single angle would no longer be sufficient under such portentous circumstances. One's whole life would be taken up in feeling or surveying the perimeter of one's acquaintances. Already, the difficulties of avoiding a collision in a crowd are enough to tax the sagacity of even a well-educated square. But if no one could calculate the regularity of a single figure in the company, all would be chaos and confusion, and the slightest panic would cause serious injuries, or, if there happened to be any women or soldiers present, perhaps considerable loss of life. Expediency, therefore, concurs with nature in stamping the seal of its approval upon regularity of conformation, nor has the law been backward in seconding their efforts. Irregularity of figure means with us the same as, or more than, a combination of moral obliquity and criminality with you, and is treated accordingly. There are not wanting, it is true, some promulgators of paradoxes who maintain that there is no necessary connection between geometrical and moral irregularity. The irregular, they say, is from his birth scouted by his own parents, derided by his brothers and sisters, neglected by the domestics, scorned and suspected by society, and excluded from all posts of responsibility, trust, and useful activity. His every movement is jealously watched by the police till he comes of age and presents himself for inspection. Then he is either destroyed, if he is found to exceed the fixed margin of deviation, or else immured in a government office as a clerk of the seventh class, prevented from marriage, forced to drudge at an uninteresting occupation for a miserable stipend, obliged to live and board at the office, and to take even his vacation under close supervision. What wonder that human nature, even in the best and purest, is embittered and perverted by such surroundings? All this very plausible reasoning does not convince me, as it has not convinced the wisest of our statesmen, that our ancestors erred in laying it down as an axiom of policy that the toleration of irregularity is incompatible with the safety of the state. Doubtless the life of an irregular is hard, but the interests of the greater number require that it shall be hard. If a man with a triangular front and a polygonal back were allowed to exist and to propagate a still more irregular posterity, what would become of the arts of life? Are the houses and doors and churches in Flatland to be altered in order to accommodate such monsters? Are our ticket collectors to be required to measure every man's perimeter before they allow him to enter a theatre or to take his place in a lecture room? Is an irregular to be exempted from the militia? And if not, how is he to be prevented from carrying desolation into the ranks of his comrades? Again, what irresistible temptations to fraudulent impostures must needs beset such a creature? How easy for him to enter a shop with his polygonal front foremost and to order goods to any extent from a confiding tradesman? Let the advocates of a falsely called philanthropy plead as they may for the abrogation of the irregular penal laws, I, for my part, have never known an irregular who was not also what nature evidently intended him to be, a hypocrite, a misanthropist, and, up to the limits of his power, a perpetrator of all manner of mischief. Not that I should be disposed to recommend, at present, the extreme measures adopted in some states, where an infant whose angle deviates by half a degree from the correct angularity is summarily destroyed at birth. Some of our highest and ablest men, men of real genius, have during their earliest days laboured under deviations as great as, or even greater, than 45 minutes, and the loss of their precious lives would have been an irreparable injury to the state. The art of healing also has achieved some of its most glorious triumphs in the compressions, extensions, trepannings, colligations, and other surgical or dietetic operations by which irregularity has been partly or wholly cured. Advocating, therefore, a via media, I would lay down no fixed or absolute line of demarcation. But at the period when the frame is just beginning to set, and when the medical board has reported that recovery is improbable, I would suggest that the irregular offspring be painlessly and mercifully consumed. End of section 7. Recording by Ruth Golding.
Please remember to support the people who support CraftLit. Visit Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. And the Loop Knittery in New Zealand at loopknittery.co.nz. And please visit the blogs and sites of CraftLit supporters. Those links can be found in the sidebar of the show notes. The show notes can be found at craftlit.com, or you can subscribe at iTunes. CraftLit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.